You are listening to Once a Raider, Always a Raider on the official Raiders Podcast Network. Here's your host, Jerry Knapp.
Hello, Raider Nation. Welcome to another edition of Once a Raider, Always a Raider. I am your host, Jerry Knack, and I am joined by two-time Super Bowl champion. He is the third leading scorer in Raiders history. He is kicker Chris Barr. Chris, welcome to the program.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me, Jerry.
Oh, you're welcome. Again, as we talked off air, I've been here with the Raiders for 18 and a half years, and I still cannot believe this is the first time we've ever spoken. This is the first time I've interviewed you. We've never crossed paths before. I'm really surprised by that.
No, and so am I, because all the different things that we've done as a Raider group over the years, we had, we all went to Las Vegas to celebrate Al Davis's life. I was just out there recently for a reunion of a couple of the Super Bowl teams, and there was a nice turnout there. And there's been a few times I've been there, so I am surprised we haven't met, but it's better late than never.
I would agree. And, you know, as a lifelong Raider fan, I've seen a lot of the big kicks that you made over the years, a lot of the games that you played in, and I've always been a fan of yours. And it is a distinct pleasure for me to finally at least get to meet you on the telephone.
Well, hopefully we'll meet in person one of these days.
Agreed. Now, I was born in Erie, Pennsylvania. You are from Pennsylvania, and you kind of started as a soccer player. How'd you get into football in the first place?
Well, it was funny. In junior high, I was, in ninth grade, watching a junior high football game. Our junior high was playing, and after the game, just kicking around on the field after the game had ended it was the high school coach's son. And the high school coach approached me and asked if I'd be willing to consider kicking the following season when I came to high school. And I had said, I'd be glad to, as long as I can still play soccer, if we can work it out somehow that, I don't have to give up playing soccer. And so I was going to kick, and during the summer, the coach retired from teaching. So they came up with a new coach, and so I didn't go out. And they played one game, and I was playing soccer, and I guess they didn't have anybody to kick. And it turns out, his son was also one of my friends, and they said, "You'd be interested in kicking?" So I went on a Thursday afternoon or a Friday morning, kicked a bunch of extra points, and was kicking with the high school that night. And I spent the next three seasons kicking on Friday nights for the football team and playing soccer during the week. I would practice once a week with the team. They used to practice Tuesday nights because we played on all our games at night. So we had one practice at night, but that was the extent of my practice time for high school.
Now, Texas high school football is legendary, right? Movies have been made about it, television shows. But my own recollection of Pennsylvania high school football, which is very, very limited to a short experience in the early 1980s, is that high school football is a big deal in Pennsylvania.
It is, especially, I know, in eastern Pennsylvania, actually in western Pennsylvania as well. I've come to think of it throughout the state. But just an interesting little tidbit that I'm going to share with everybody. My older son, who's 29, managed the stadium that was featured in that Friday Night Lights football game.
Oh, wow.
He managed that facility. It was also a minor league baseball park as well there. And he just left the job about a year ago. But anyway, back to Pennsylvania football, we had a league that was a really good league in eastern Pennsylvania. It consisted of two teams from my area, which was just outside of Philadelphia. Then we had two teams from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, two teams from Allentown. A team from Easton was called the Big Seven. And we would get, I can still remember playing Bethlehem, I think it was at Freedom, and they played in an 18,000-seat stadium. We filled the place, and they still turned a bunch of people away. We were the two undefeated teams in the state at the time. And so we used to get on a regular basis, 6, 8, 10,000 a night. So it was a pretty big deal back there. And, they still play a high school all-star game called the Big 33 game, which is Ohio against Pennsylvania. or it was Ohio against Pennsylvania. It may be, I think it still is, but they play it at Hershey Park in the middle, you know, before these kids go off to college. So it is, even in central Pennsylvania, you know, they fill up the high school stadium for each game.
There are a lot of big colleges in Pennsylvania, starting with the University of Pittsburgh, all the way to the east with Temple, and Villanova had football back then. How did you end up at Penn State?
It was free. There weren't a lot of scholarships being given out at the time. I mean, I looked at Penn State and a couple of Ivy League schools, and being the materialistic weasel that I am, Penn State gave me the best opportunity to kick and play soccer. So I was allowed for two seasons just to play soccer. They had a kicker that had 2 years left, and then I kicked for 2 years and played soccer, and then I had 1 year of eligibility. So they gave me the best opportunity to do both at the time. Plus, it was a good school to boot educationally.
Now, you joined that Penn State team right as the Nittany Lions are becoming this national power, prominent football school. What was playing for them at that time like for you, and also for the university?
Well, it was about that time that they started getting really good in the late 60s, 68, 69, 70. And my first season was 73. And I was fortunate to play on an undefeated team. We were 12-0, and it turns out, little factoid, that we were the first 12-0 team in football because we were the first team that played 12 games. It wasn't that nobody could have done it. How it's changed now, I played in a stadium at Penn State that housed 60,000 and looked like a giant Erector set. It was the largest metal stadium in the country. And now, as everybody's probably, well, not everybody's aware of, but they hold 108 to 110,000 there, and it's all enclosed. So it's changed quite a bit, but it was certainly fun back then. My first season as well, that was the year John Cappelletti won the Heisman Trophy. So just kind of interesting things along the way.
I think John Cappelletti is one of those great running backs that people have kind of forgotten about. You know, his brother's story was immortalized in a book and a movie in the 70s. His brother had leukemia. But, you know, John was one of the reasons I became a Penn State fan as a kid after I learned that story.
Yeah, and we all watched that live, the Heisman acceptance speech, and there wasn't a dry eye in the house. And, you know, so when they made the movie, you know, we know all the principles that they were, you know, talking about and whatnot. But I always thought John was a guy, even as a professional, that didn't quite get the, you know, I know he won the Heisman, but never quite got the due I thought he deserved. I know he was, with the Rams and a good running back with them, and I think Lawrence McCutcheon was there at the same time. But John was just a really good running back.
And that Rams team of the 70s, you know, we talk about the Raiders here all the time. The Raiders went to six AFC championship games in the 70s, including five in a row. But the Rams went to six NFC championship games during that time frame. And obviously, Cappelletti was a big part of that. Wendell Tyler came in a little bit later on. But, you know, between Pat Hayden and Vince Ferragamo, a quarterback, Cappelletti was part of a lot of good teams.
They had the great defenses back in those days. I think they had that big defensive line there, so they were awfully good.
Raider Nation, you're listening to Once a Raider, Always a Raider. I'm talking to number three all-time leading scorer in Raiders history, kicker Chris Barr. That leads me right into transitioning to your time as a professional. You were drafted in the second round in 1976 by the Cincinnati Bengals in the second round. First of all, second round is pretty high for a kicker.
Yeah, they got in a little stretch there where they were taking kickers a little high. It started with Ray Guy, you know, with the Raiders drafting him number one. And there was a few handful of years in there that they were looking at people pretty high. And, teams like the Raiders were trying to replace Blanda. I guess teams were just kicking more, and I was fortunate to, get picked up in the second round. Unfortunate that the Raiders didn't take me the pick before, but it all worked out in the end.
I was going to say, it does have a way of working itself out. Now, you spent 4 years with Cincinnati up until 1979. Now, in 76, the Raiders drafted a kicker in the fifth round, Fred Steinfort, but he gets hurt in his rookie season and doesn't play another game for the Raiders. Raiders bring in Errol Mann, and then later on bring in Jim Breach in 1979, and you get let go by the Bengals in 79. You end up with the Raiders. Breach ends up with the Bengals, but you know more to the story than that.
Yeah, it was. A lot of people think we just switched right there, but we really didn't. And the crazy thing about the whole switch in the first place, Jimmy had a terrific season the year before, and I don't think it had anything to do necessarily with his season that he had, as opposed to, I think, from what I gathered, the Raiders always hoped to get me back after they passed in the draft. So when the opportunity arose, you know, they did. But the interesting thing about the switch was the Bengals had actually picked up a kid from Canadian football that had played for Forrest Gregg up there, and he kicked the first four or five games of the season. And his last game with the Bengals was against the Raiders in Oakland. So, and Jim Breach took over the very next week and stayed there for, I don't know, what, 15 years or however many years he played.
Quite a long career.
So, yeah, it all worked out for everyone involved. And Jimmy, with his large family, got to raise them in Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky. And he had a great career. And so it all worked out for both of us.
Well, you had a tryout with Tampa Bay before you came to Oakland.
Yeah, I got released by the Bengals. I knew I was going. I kept asking, why don't you just let me go now, because I'd like to have an opportunity to kick somewhere else. And when I did get released, as soon as I cleared waivers, because I had the years in where I didn't have to take someone picking me up off of waivers, the first teams to call were Tampa and Oakland. And the people in Tampa, it was Ron Wolf, I believe, at the time. And so I went and I kicked for both places. I was pretty sure, given the opportunity, where I wanted to go, but I figured I owed it to myself to go to both places. And it was just such a stark contrast in the way they greeted me when I got there. In Tampa, it was sort of, I guess, cold and businesslike, which is sort of what you expect with the Raiders. We had Coach Flores and Mr. Davis came by, and it was just a much more, which is odd for a Raider team, kind of warm and fuzzy type feeling. As much as it could be. And so I had my tryout. I flew home and flew back and, you know, kicked that next week, which was opening day in Kansas City.
Well, that first season for you was 1980, and you scored 98 points that year. Team goes 11-5, qualifies for the wild card, and becomes the first wild card team to win a Super Bowl by beating Philadelphia in Super Bowl 15 at the Superdome in New Orleans. Now, that year did not start off great. The team was 2-3 when starting quarterback Dan Pastorini broke his leg and Jim Plunkett had to come off the bench to become the starting quarterback. What got the season on track? What got you guys going?
I hate that loss to San Diego. Dan had broken his leg during the San Diego game, and Jim had a sort of a really good game. And if the kicker could have kicked a little, we might have won. But it wasn't one of my best days. But I think that gave us a little bit of confidence. And then we had two. I think we went on the road. We had a Monday night game the following week against the Steelers in Pittsburgh, and I think that win sort of got us on track. They were the defending champions, and we sort of built on that sort of momentum. And at the end of the year, everybody that made the playoffs was 11-5, and we ended up being a wild card, you know, due to all the tiebreakers. But it was certainly quite the run, and I think it was a combination of a number of things. But if you look at how guys played, I think an awful lot of guys on that team had career years in this at the same time. And it just all sort of fell together late in the season. And it was a heck of a run through the playoffs. It was, you know, we played in that minus 37 degree weather in Cleveland. We had, you know, the shootout against the Chargers, and then, you know, handled the Eagles, you know, I guess, fairly easy. Rod Martin with his three interceptions, and it was kind of a fun run. And it was an interesting collection of players that made that run.
You're not kidding
I'll
about career years, you know, right? You know, Lester Hayes was the NFL Defensive Player of the Year that year with 13 interceptions. You know, obviously Plunkett's resurrection with his career after what happened in New England with the Patriots and then later with the 49ers before he came to the Raiders. And it, like you said, you know, Kenny King comes in. I spoke to Kenny a week ago and talked about that run and you know, kind of how all the pieces did come together. You obviously were definitely a piece of that puzzle. I spoke at length with Tom Flores several weeks ago about that game in Cleveland. The Browns were known as the Cardiac Kids that year. Brian Sipe had a fantastic year at quarterback. But I think Sam Ratigliano, right or wrong, gets vilified for that play call. At the end of the game, it's 14-12 Raiders, and instead of going to Don Cockcroft, who had missed kicks earlier in the game or had a kick blocked, he decides he's going to go for the win and go for a touchdown with a pass play to Hall of Fame tight end Ozzie Newsome, but Mike Davis picks it off for the Raiders to preserve the victory. What do you remember about that game and the field conditions and that play call decision?
That's the coldest I've ever been in my life. The field was, you know, Cleveland field was never a great field anyway. Late in the year, it was kind of all dirt, and they painted it green, so it looked good on TV. But the field was frozen. You know, they didn't have the big tarp system. You know, everything wasn't like it is now, and they take all sorts of precautions. And so half the field seemed to be frozen, and half the field was covered with this liquid that they used to thaw some of it. So, you know, had good, not good footing, but you had footing that wasn't frozen, and then you had some that was frozen, and you know, everybody's hands were numb, and it just was a game. There was no sure bet that he was going to make. I think it would have been about a 30-32 yard field goal. And the interesting thing that we remember about what I heard later on was their instructions were, if he's not open, throw it in Lake Erie and then they'll try to kick the field goal. And Mike Davis, and God love him, didn't have the greatest hands that you ever saw for a defensive back, and which was another thing that was amazing. He was the one, you know, he played great defense, but to actually hang on in that position and intercept it in those conditions was basically incredible. But, you know, kicking was no, like I did it by just really shortening up my steps, and fortunately, I only had to try two extra points, but you were basically numb in the 3 minutes it took to leave the bench, go kick the extra point, and then kick off. And, yeah, you can't blame them for trying to score because, like I said, it was no – there's no gimme there.
And on top of that, too, all season long, that's how they were winning ball games, right? They were the Cardiac Kids winning games at last-second heroics and last-minute touchdown drives. Why wouldn't they take a shot, right?
Yeah, that's what I said. That was their nature, and you know, I would certainly have thought they, you know, if they, the worst they thought was going to happen, they throw an incompletion and then they try the field goal. So, yeah, I certainly would never second guess what they tried to do.
Right, Raider Nation, you're listening to Once a Raider, Always a Raider. I'm your host Jerry Nack, and I'm speaking with former Raiders kicker, two-time Super Bowl champ, Chris Barr. Chris, from 1983 to 1985, you had your three best years statistically, at least point scoring-wise. You had over 100 points each year. And in 1983, you had a career high of 114 points. That also happened to be the year the Raiders went 12-4, rocketed through the playoffs, and crushed the Redskins in Super Bowl 18. What do you remember about that team?
That team, I still say, doesn't get the credit it deserves in terms of all-time great teams. I mean, we had the best cornerback tandem they've been voted that with Lester and Mike Haynes. But that team, if you go back and look at the season, there was a stretch in the middle of the year where we turned the ball over a lot. Just funny, numbers stick with me. I'm a financial advisor, and for some reason numbers stick in my head. When we played Seattle, I think we turned the ball over during the season in two games 11 times against Seattle and lost both of those games. When we didn't turn the ball over, if you go back and look at the scores, we didn't have one close game. Of the 12 victories and the playoff wins, we didn't have in the playoffs, we didn't have a close game. And we didn't turn the ball over at all. And that team, to me, was the best collection of players I've been around. And I don't think it gets the respect in terms of all-time great teams. And, yeah. But if you go look at it sometime and look at the scores and look at the turnovers, when we didn't turn it over, we weren't touchable that year.
Thanks for the homework, Chris. Appreciate it.
Yeah, well,
I'll have to go take a look at that.
Yeah. We went through like a 6-game stretch where we turned it over a bunch. We lost 3 and won 3. And in 4 of those, it came down to either us making a field goal or us blocking a field goal in there. So it just was an interesting season. And we stopped turning it over late in the year. We didn't turn it over early and we didn't turn it over late. In the middle, we turned it over a lot.
We still went 12-4 and dominated throughout the playoffs and yeah. Won Super Bowl 18. You played for the Raiders from 1980 to 1988, and you're a numbers guy. I'm not good with math, but you played with quite a collection of members of the Pro Football Hall of Fame, including Ted Hendricks and as you mentioned, Mike Haynes. You were with Art Shell.
Gene Upshaw.
What was that like? Did you realize it at the time that you were playing with guys of that caliber? What was it like playing with all of those Hall of Famers?
I think you always knew how good they all were. But as teammates, you don't really look at it, you know, that way. When you look back on things, you know, Art and Gene were, you know, that side of the line. But even the other side, they were awfully good people on the other side of the ball. We had a lot of talent in those years, and we probably, you know, should have won a couple of more Super Bowls based on the people that we had. And even that's football, though, you know, you go ahead and you make some dopey mistakes. But yeah, those players, you look back at Ted Hendricks, I always thought he was one of the smartest guys on the football field. He had a nose for the ball, you know, hence his knack of picking up fumbles and blocking kicks and all the things that he did. And, you know, it was a team that was interesting, and they had a good attitude. We, you know, had the reputation that we had, which all teams were like us, but we had that reputation as the bad boys with the, you know, the patch on the eye and, you know, that type of thing. But those were really professional guys. When it came time to play on Sunday, everybody played, and they, you know, we didn't do stupid things and make mistakes. And I'll tell you one little tidbit, Ted Hendricks. Well, I don't know if I should give you the whole thing. When I first went there, he told me there's two rules here: play on Sunday and stay out of jail. And he said, and then he said the second one, not real important. But, you know, obviously he was kidding, and, you know, we weren't out doing crazy things, but you had to play on Sunday. And, you know, I think some of the players that have come after maybe forgot the play on Sunday part. Mm. That was our motto. You know, Al had the just win, baby thing, but it really meant something to all those guys. And, you had to play on Sunday, and that was the mentality that they had. And I think that's one of the reasons a lot of them were so great, is they never took a minute off.
Well, your career spanned some interesting times with the franchise and also the National Football League. 82, there's a work stoppage. You only play 9 games. Team is the number one seed in the AFC. You beat Cleveland in the first round, but then lose to the Jets in the second round. And then in 87, they play with replacement players. after after a work stoppage, and you also were with the team during the move to Los Angeles.
Yep, I was there during the whole time. That I'm glad you brought up the jet loss, because that still bothers us today. That was a game that, when it was done, people were like numb for a month. We sort of just gave it away, and that killed us. But I played through. The replacement players, the strike, the 9-game season was a little odd, but you do what you have to do. And we played the number of games we had, but that team during the strike season was a team that we probably should have won with. I thought the team that lost to New England in the playoffs, I don't know if I remember, it was before, I think it was the year after the.
It was 85, and
85. That was a good team, and we just gave. I remember that game pretty vividly. We were going in to score to go up 24-0 or something, and we ended up turning the ball over, and they came back and made it 17-7, and then we made a bunch of mistakes, and but that's that. Like I said, that's football, and that's how the game goes, and a bounce here, a bounce there. My older son, who I mentioned earlier, is a big. Raider fan. He picked it up on his own. I don't think it had anything, because he never really saw me play. He was too young. And, his attitude, he's always got a good attitude, even now, a bounce here and there, and, maybe we're in the hunt,
Right.
So that's football, though. A bounce here or there, and it changes seasons.
It sure does. It really does.
That Tuck Rule game in New England sort of changed the fortunes of two franchises, I think, in that one night.
I'm not going to disagree with you.
Yeah.
Chris, you also had another family member who was a kicker who followed in your footsteps at Penn State and then in the National Football League, your brother Matt.
Yep, Matt. We were 3 years apart age-wise, and so through high school and college, we sort of followed each other, and he went to Penn State as well and did the same thing with the soccer deal. And, Matt had a really good career. He's 17 seasons, and I'm going to give him a little plug. I always thought he was one of the best clutch kickers I ever saw.
That's something else I can't disagree with. All those years with the Pittsburgh Steelers, he played in a lot of big games as well. Was it ever weird playing against him?
Nah, because we're never on the field at the same time. But even if we were, it wouldn't be, when you're playing a game, you do your best to win. And the only thing I always hoped for when we played each other was that the game wouldn't come down to either one of us with a last, and not that we decide, but it wouldn't come down to a last second field goal. And it only happened one time, and it was a preseason game, and they had a field goal to win the game and prevent the game from going into overtime. And our guys even thanked them for making it, because nobody wants to play overtime in preseason.
No.
Fortunately, it never came down to a kick in those games, so it was easy on my parents.
There you go.
But we played a lot over there. We played a lot over the years when he was with Cleveland, when he was with Pittsburgh. We played a number of times.
Were you guys cognizant of the rivalry between the Raiders and Steelers that spilled over from the 70s into the early 80s? Was that ever a topic of discussion?
Well, the interesting thing, he only played 2 years with the Steelers. In his 17 seasons, he only was there for 2 years. And it's funny, a lot of Pittsburgh people think he was there for a long time. But so, we were certainly well aware of it. We had watched the Immaculate Reception and, all the things that had happened with them over the years and the games. And, we knew that. Having grown up in Pennsylvania and going to Penn State, you were certainly well aware of that rivalry. But I did not play against him. If I remember, when he was with the Steelers.
Gotcha.
When he was with the Steelers, I was still with the Bengals, I believe. Yeah, maybe 1 year, maybe that first season. But I don't know that we played each other in the regular season.
Gotcha.
Played him when he played with Cleveland a bunch of times. So,
think it's remarkable that two brothers had such remarkable careers at the same position. you know, you guys were part of kind of this modern explosion of popularity of the National Football League.
Yeah, I think it certainly did grow, and it, you know, I look back on, you know, our Super Bowls and how the weeks that we were there were handled, and now what the league has become, and with the concerts and, you know, the booths and, you know, all the NFL experience stuff, and it certainly has exploded, and it was sort of exploding at the end of our careers. It was getting bigger and bigger, but I think the NFL has always been fairly big, so
right.
It just has got that much bigger.
Gotcha. Chris, you scored 817 points as a Raider in your 9 years with the Silver and Black. You made 162 field goals, 331 extra points. Are you surprised that you're still third on that list?
Yeah, in some respects I am. In other respects, you know, how many kickers get to stick around a place for 9 seasons? So. So it had a lot to do with longevity. And plus, I played on good teams that scored a lot. That makes a difference. And the other side of it is anytime they have someone that's getting close to overtaking me, I put a call into ownership and see if, you know, what they can do about getting rid of them.
Is that what happened with Jeff Jaeger?
So I can keep my pace, keep my place. Yeah.
Jeff got up to 667 and then he was gone.
Yeah, well, that's, I said, it's rare you get to kick for a team for that long a time, and even more rare now that they kick for one team that long. So,
well, you know, back when you played, there seemed to be this group of great kickers, right? Rolf Benerska, Pete Stojanovic. There was a lot of great kickers in the NFL at that time.
We were in the era where it was there were still a number of, as they used to say, conventional straight-on kickers, and it was transitioning into the soccer-style kicking. And, yeah, we maybe were the beginning of something, but these guys today are really good. The guys kicking, yep. And, you know, there's a number. One, they're really good. You know, they have a dedicated holder, snapper. You know, they're playing on great fields. A lot of times they're indoors, and even the outdoor ones are generally enclosed. But these guys today are really good, and they're sort of at times a victim of their own successes, and they're taking a little bit of a beating this year. It's just one of those seasons that they're missing some field goals, and, you know, everybody talks about extra points like they're still extra points. They are extra points only in name. It's still a 32-yard field goal. And
right.
If you go back in history and see how many field goals between 30 and 35 yards were missed, they didn't make every one of them. And, you know, they're still thinking it's, you know, 20 yards away. And because it's called an extra point, it should be automatic.
As a matter of fact, you were 53 of 75 from that
distance.
You were 53 of 75 from that distance as a Raider.
Yeah, well, that's not too good these days. It wouldn't keep my job. But like I said, it was, you know, we didn't have, you know, we had a center that was playing 13 plays, you know, prior to that with his hands all beat up and snapping. We didn't have, you know, they changed the rules that I guess the center really can't get hit now. So it can be a smaller, more nimble guy. And that's all they do. You know, John Kondo, how long did he kick it or snap out there? That was his one job.
Right.
We didn't have one of those. We had Dave Dalby, you know, and Dave did a great job, but Dave was playing, 60 offensive plays a game.
Right.
And it's different. And we had a wide receiver hold or a backup quarterback. It wasn't a punter that had all sorts of time to get good at it. But that's just how the game has evolved. And these guys are really good. And, you know, anymore, if you're not kicking, you know, 80% of your field goals, or more, they're looking to replace you with somebody.
I think the one thing that stands out to me, aside from what you just talked about, which all valid points, is the leg strength with these kickers. You look at Sebastian Janikowski, who was here for you know, 17 years, he set the NFL record for most field goals of 50-plus. These guys are long-range bombers with their field goals now.
Yes, they are. And like I said, they're really good, and they do a good job. You know, it's still 50 yards plus, and you have to keep it between. But I'm going to tell you a little story, and I don't know if I should. But my son, again, I'm bringing back my older son, that he actually had a workout with the Steelers. He kicked in college for four seasons. And in college, he could kick from 52, 53 and sort of be okay. Okay, that was the outside of his range. He had a workout with the Steelers. They brought kicking balls right out of the boxes, so brand new K-balls. He said he was kicking balls from 55 and 58 yards that were looked like they were still going up, going through the right, through the uprights. Wow. Those balls are lively. they're strong. These guys are strong, but yeah.
And we're juicing. We're juicing the footballs just like they juice the balls in
not
baseball.
Juicing. Not juicing the footballs. Just a lively ball. I'm not saying any. We used to have tricks to try to get balls. You know, a new ball looking old because, but. Like I said, he went from one day where, you know, 52, 53 was his range to, you know, 60 being easy. And he didn't get that much stronger in 3 days. So give him the quarterback balls now. Let them kick. No, I sound like an old player, like bemoaning the fact that they're this good. I'm impressed with how good these kids are. And they are getting stronger. Everybody gets stronger, you know, all over the years, baseball, everything. But you can only, like, hit that little white golf ball so far. You know, you can only compress it so far.
Right.
And the same with the football. You can only compress it so far. So if you've compressed it as far as it can go, and then you kick one that goes further, it means it's a little more lively. So that's my two cents. My brother will back me up on it.
He still has a bunch of
balls from the old days. He said I had to bring them out and let them kick them for a game and see how it goes.
Yeah, see how they.
There's not a kid in that league that can't kick the ball out of the back of the end zone.
Right, and this is true.
You know, and
they keep changing the rules on kickoffs too.
Well, I can understand not wanting. Yeah, but then you got teams like New England that go ahead and kick it off to the one, so you have to return it. That was the old Seattle Seahawks. They did that all the time. They had a kid named Norm Johnson that could kick it a mile in the air, and he made sure it didn't go in the end zone, so they had to run it back. And we were always inside our 10 because invariably we get tackled at the 19 and get called for holding.
Well, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
That's the truth. Yep.
Well, Chris, I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with me today on Once a Raider, Always a Raider. You had quite the career, two-time Super Bowl champion, still number three all-time in points scored in Raiders history behind Sebastian Janikowski and Hall of Famer George Blanda. I really appreciate the time and the stories and the remembrances. It's been great.
Well, thanks for having me, and let's hope that we can get this thing turned around out there and get a Raider team that, you know, has some more playoffs in them.
I will second that.
Yes.
That's going to do it for this edition of Once a Raider, Always a Raider. For Chris Barr, I have been Jerry Knack. We'll talk to you next time. And as always, go Raiders.
Thank you for listening to Once a Raider, Always a Raider on the official Raiders Podcast Network.